Welcome to the Big Mike Fund Podcast, where you'll learn about advanced wealth building strategies from real estate investing to creating massive ROI and secured retirement profits. So pour yourself a cup of coffee, grab a notepad, and lean in, because Big Mike has got the mic, starting now.
Welcome to the Big Mike Fund Podcast. I'm the Big Mike, Mike Zlotnik, and today it is my pleasure and a privilege to welcome Matt Burke. Hi, Matt.
Hey, Mike.
Great to have you on the podcast. Matt is the founder and CEO of Fairway America, and you also have given birth to the Verivest. It's the fund administration company. But before we jump into that, could you tell the audience a little bit about Matt? I know you live in Portland, you have a family, just a couple of words about you, and I know you bike a lot, so.
Yeah, born and raised in California, been in Portland for close to 30 years, started the company in 1992, so been here a long time. I have a wife, two sons, both in high school, sophomore and senior. I like to ride a road bike. Wish I could get more miles in than I do, but that's a little bit about me.
Thank you for that. So let's talk a little bit about Fairway America. Just give a very brief history. You have a great company. We love working with you. We feel honored working with your team. It's a phenomenal, high integrity, absolutely great organization. So appreciate you coming on the podcast and just tell a little bit about you, your company, and your team.
Yeah. Fairway, thank you for the nice words. I appreciate that, Mike, and always appreciate your guys' support and business. I started it 28 years ago. I've really been in the real estate finance business my whole career. The first 8 or 10 years or so was originating residential and commercial real estate loans. Eventually, I just did commercial only and private money only and matched investors one at a time with first trust deeds here in the Pacific Northwest. Started our first fund in about 1999, launched it in 2000, and have since gone on and we're on, I think, our 10th pooled investment fund at this point. Ran those pretty successfully until and through the Great Recession. And at that time, I wound down a fund for the first time. We actually ended up getting investors, you know, more money than they put in by the time it was all over. So that was a good outcome. But that sort of precipitated a change in our business model that over the last 8 or 9 years, we've really focused heavily on helping small balance and middle market real estate entrepreneurs try to grow and scale their company. And I define a small balance or a middle market real estate entrepreneur, Mike, as any real estate asset-based investment professional who runs a company that requires them to raise money on an ongoing basis from investors. And if you qualify as that definition, then everybody who does that knows how challenging it is to try to balance all the different components of running that business, from originating assets to managing and executing a business plan on those assets, to raising capital for those assets, performing investor relations for those assets, doing the accounting and the tax, all the securities regulations that go along with it, and doing that consistently and repeatedly for enough deals that allow somebody to scale that business is an incredibly challenging undertaking. So our whole business, both Fairway and Verivest, is designed to provide key support to those people in the areas of their business that most of them don't really love, which is often all the things that don't have anything directly to do with the real estate component. That's what we do. We've done a lot of fund advisory work. We do fund administration. We do back office accounting. We help people in their capital markets and their IR. We partner with them. We do co-GP arrangements with middle market sponsors. And so it's a variety of things to really focus on that target audience.
Yeah, that's great summary of what you do. I kind of think of it as you provide almost institutional level services to a smaller sponsors. And this, it's hard for smaller sponsors to find this type of a solution anywhere else. And the other thing you do absolutely great job at is finding these small balance middle market specialists that have their niche, that convert hotels to affordable housing, or they do distressed commercial debt, or they do multifamily value adds in Midwest. And all these connections are extremely valuable, and it makes a great difference to your sponsors that they don't have to spend time on all the boring things and not the exciting things, but instead execute on their strategy. So I think it's a great niche, and I'm certainly excited to be part of your ecosystem in investing with you and many of your sponsors. And we find this is a great area of opportunity for a lot of high net worth, non-institutional investors, because the big boys can write big checks into billion-dollar funds. But a lot of small investors struggle to find high-quality opportunities. There's a lot of garbage out there, and the quality stuff is hard to find. And that's where you play a vital role. Let me kind of start with basics, and I want to focus this podcast on the areas of opportunities now. We live in the COVID or post-COVID world. But before I do that, I just want to ask one simple question that has come up many times. And it's a fundamental question. So the question comes up, what's the real difference between investing in a fund and a syndication? Because it comes up all the time. People don't particularly know the difference. I just wanted to, it's a basic question, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on that real fundamental concept.
Well, I would define a fund as a vehicle that has both multiple assets and multiple investors, right? Whereas a syndication would have one asset and multiple investors. So it's a fund is a order of magnitude more complicated in terms of understanding all the nuances and how to run it and how to account for it properly and so forth. From an investor perspective, I think there are I don't think one is inherently better or worse than the other. I think it depends on the investor, what their objectives are, how bold and sophisticated they are at being able to pick assets themselves and pick managers themselves, what their needs are from a, you know, a cash flow versus capital gain versus depreciation perspective. Right. So there's a lot of choices, but at the end of the day, Mike, I mean, they both have their pluses and minuses. I think a fund, a well-run fund by a quality manager, provides more diversity than a syndication because you invested across, you know, multiple assets typically. It also provides, it can provide some liquidity options in an open-ended fund structure, but the ability for that liquidity to be there depends on the nature of the underlying assets. Whereas a syndication, I think the advantages to an investor there for people who like this is they can pick and choose those assets. They have a little bit more control over what they're investing in and not investing in. You know, in a fund, you're investing in a vehicle that has a specific mandate that's articulated in those offering documents. But as an investor, you don't have any control over which assets you're picking and, you know, the manager is picking. Whereas in a syndication, you can look at the deal and say, yes or no, I like this deal or I don't like this deal or the characteristics of that deal. But you're also in a, if there's a problem in that particular deal that investor chose, then they're a little bit more exposed to that specific investment as opposed to having, you know, the diversity of a fund. So again, I'd say pluses and minuses, neither is inherently right or wrong or better than the other. They're just different. And it's important to understand what those differences are.
Great commentary. I think you explained some of the key points and some of the main benefits like diversification and some of the uncertainty related to many assets. Now, I was recently asked the following two questions and they show a little bit of complexity and uncertainty with funds because funds acquire assets over time. So one of the questions I was asked, what states I'm going to have to file in. Yeah. And it's difficult to answer if the fund is raising capital for a couple of years, whether it's an open-ended or closed-ended, you don't know what the future investments will look like. And the other one was, what's the projected depreciation in a given year of a fund? And you don't know until you get the K-1s, it becomes hard to estimate. Single assets a little bit easier, but the lack of diversification is a big risk. So anyway, let's switch, great answers. Let's switch to the main subject of this podcast, COVID. And it has greatly differentiated the winners and the losers. Unfortunately, there have been a lot of losers. And even the stock market, two-thirds of the market is down while one-third is substantially up. But in real estate, what do you see the opportunities now? We know hospitality got hurt badly. Retail got hurt, but appears to be recovering pretty well, obviously subject to local and dynamics and specific project. But what are the great opportunities now? What do you see? We're at Q4 2020. Where are the opportunities now, and where are we going?
Yeah, and you know, Mike, that's a hard question, but I would say it depends a lot on what sub-market somebody is playing in, both what asset sub-market, what geographic sub-market. So there's a lot of variances from one to the other. And so I can give some generalizations, which is really probably the best way to answer that question. As you point out, I think hospitality has been hurt very badly, although even some subsectors of hospitality have held up well. You know, driving distance, leisure type properties have actually done pretty well, whereas, you know, business oriented conference centers and city centers have really been hurt. So again, it just depends on the subsector. But I would say, you know, one of the things that I'm seeing a number of people doing, and we've participated in this and are active in this subsector, is converting hotels and motels in infill locations into affordable or workforce housing, multifamily, and, you know, small studio and one bedroom units, but very much on the affordable end of the scale. There still is a very large shortage of affordable and workforce housing in this country. So I think that's a big opportunity. We also have been involved in repurposing some retail properties, big boxes, into other uses. And in our case, specifically, it's been self-storage. I see retail being repurposed into many different things, including warehouses, industrial, logistics and distribution, you know, call centers. I was seeing even some office, although that's certainly less post-COVID. But I just think that theme, Mike, of repurposing existing property for other uses that are more in line with today's post-COVID world seems to be a trend. Industrial property generally has held up extremely well. There's very large demand from investors, particularly institutional investors, for industrial assets that are involved in distribution and logistics. As you, I'm sure you well know, the online percentage of online shopping and retail has risen dramatically. So there's a huge need for distribution of products to people. Multifamily has held up quite well, although I think that's even depending on the subsector of the market. The high-end Class A infill expensive property has not held up nearly as well as, you know, Class B and C, kind of middle of the road or affordable, more affordable type housing. So I think repurposing is a big opportunity. I think there's opportunity in smaller deals that are below the typical institutional size. So there's fewer players that are going to come in and bid up prices. So some of the middle market entrepreneurs can take advantage of some pretty attractive cap rates. Interest rates, as you know, are very, very low. Although, you know, debt's widely available for multifamily and industrial, much less so for retail, hospitality, and, you know, office is kind of somewhere in between. You know, I read a lot of material about where the market's going, and I, you know, consistently see, and everybody's got an opinion, but I think office is very difficult to get your arms around at the moment. I think long term it probably holds up pretty well, but short run, it's challenging. It's just challenging for people to underwrite and for lenders to underwrite.
Let's talk a little bit about some specific examples and some of the projects we've invested together with you and your funds, and I'm pretty excited about some of them. There's one project we talked about in Ogden, Utah. It was pre-COVID deal. It was a hotel conversion to multifamily, mm-hmm. and it looks to be a massive blockbuster. Just curious, how that particular project we were chatting, the exit price was supposed to be 18 million in 5 years, and we're getting offers at 21 million now, and it's a hotel conversion to multifamily. Is that because of lower interest rate? What just happened? How can a good deal become a great deal? And then just curious on that particular project, a little bit of commentary.
Well, I think in that particular project, part of it was the hotel wasn't doing very well beforehand. So we picked it up at a very good basis in the first place. In that submarket, multifamily vacancy is extremely low, and there just was really no product in kind of the downtown core. And I mean, Ogden's not a big market, but you know, it does have a university there, Weber State, and it is a pretty good sized submarket of Salt Lake. But there was just big demand for the units, and as the units came online, they pretty much filled up just about as fast as we could get them built. So we were able to get it done. And that's another thing, depending on the layout of the units on hospitality, some are much more conducive than others to a very quick turn. I mean, and as you know, you participated in this one, but the one that we closed in North Carolina recently was a Marriott Residence Inn that already had kitchens in them. So the amount of work involved in converting it was much less than something where you actually have to go in and build out, you know, sinks and kitchens and plumbing and so forth. In the case of the one in Ogden, it had been condominiumized years ago by a previous developer. I mean, 30 or 40 years ago. So they had already consolidated 300 units down to 100 units. So they're very, I mean, they're sizable units for a hospitality property, you know, in the 500 square foot range. So, as you also know, Mike, I mean, some deals seem to work out really well and other deals have challenges that come along that you don't anticipate. And that's part of the business. And, you know, back to your question around the difference between a fund and a syndication, you know, you get stuck in one of them that seems to be cursed or doesn't quite go as well as you think it's going to. And, you know, the goal is on the downside, look, you know, you might not hit a home run, but you want to just not get crushed, right? I mean, I want the downside to be, you know, hey, it didn't work out the way we thought, but hey, we at least got our money back and, you know, you live to fight another day. You know, that's what we try to strive for and making good decisions so that when things don't go well, you know, hey, you can live with it and you move on. But it is nice when they do go well and, you know, you get the kind of price that we're, you know, at least under LOI on right now. I mean, and I'll knock on wood, Mike, as I say that, because, you know, as you know, in this business, nothing's ever done till it's done.
What does Warren Buffett say? Don't lose money. That's the, it's a good philosophy. And you guys do a great job underwriting for, you know, stress test conservative scenarios, because the projects do go sometimes not perfectly. The problems that do happen. We live in an imperfect world.
But things outside your control. That, I mean, you look at hospitality. I mean, I've got some friends of mine that, you know, sponsors that are in the hotel space that have been in it for their whole life and, you know, 30 plus years and extremely good operators. And COVID comes along and shuts things down. And, you know, they're in a real pinch through absolutely no fault of their own, right? So to some degree, you know, that is the way the world works, right? Things happen and you can't control everything. So try to control the things you can control and limit your downside. And, you know, that's that we like people that think that way.
Yeah, exactly. What you said, I've said this many times, I continue to say this. If you don't diversify, I mean, it works sometimes much better than if you do. Diversification is boring. But COVID is an example where diversified strategy among many dimensions and many asset classes, including hospitality, if you were not overloaded in that sector, you would have been much better off. So it's one of those things that when you talk to really smart people and they say, well, diversification is for people who can't make their own decisions, they can't figure out how to invest well. It's true. If you're a specialist, you can make good decisions. You too much power to you. But there is the good old protection mechanism, spreading the risk across many things, many sectors, sponsors, regions, dimensions, debt equity, all that creates safety and downside protection when things don't go, you know, the way they don't go. But let's talk a little bit more about other opportunities. So hotel conversions are great. Obviously, value add multifamily kind of 101 in any market, but conversions to self-storage. So you guys got a self-storage fund. We are in that fund. We've invested in that. We've invested into other self-storage conversions. And I love the sector. It's a great theme. But the question is, I'm a little bit worried about oversupply. There's a lot of conversions hitting the market now, and it's an easy, well, easy year, not easy, but easier than ground up construction to convert. But it is what's preventing somebody else getting some similar done in a given area, and suddenly you build a great product and wind up with more competition than expected, and the rates get hit, unfortunately. It's just something to think about.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you that if you look across the board in storage, the amount of supply that's come online the last few years has been significant. So there is I'd call it macro level supply issue that is putting downward pressure on rents. But in the storage business, it's very much a micro business. And anybody who's been in that business for a long time will tell you that it's a 1 mile, 3 mile, 5 mile radius business. And there's metrics that you can fairly easily obtain around supply in that finite radius, number of households in that radius, the income of those households. And there's 8 or 10 measures of what tends to drive demand for self-storage. So part of the advantage of the conversions is picking those micro markets that have lower supply and are more immune to, you know, the global supply issue. And I would actually disagree with you on the notion that it's easier to convert than build from the ground up. I think it's actually exactly the opposite. If you buy a piece of land that is zoned for self-storage, it's very easy to just slap up a new facility on that land. And that's often what has contributed to the supply problem, is that people will just buy the land, build storage because they think storage is great without regard to those metrics. And that tends to happen in markets where there's a available supply of land that already is zoned for that use, right? And so that's oftentimes in suburban markets or growing markets, or your outskirts of, you know, Dallas or Vegas or Phoenix or something, where you just have, you know, more and more land you can keep building on. In a conversion of a retail facility, it's generally speaking, Mike, it's not zoned to allow for storage, and going through the process of getting it converted from retail use to storage use is a beating. I mean, it is very, very difficult because the municipality does not generally want storage there because it doesn't generate the same tax revenue and jobs in that community as retail. So you have a lot of these local, you know, city council members who are just, you know, local folks that got elected to that, you know, position, who really don't understand real estate and are just hanging on to the notion that somehow that vacant Kmart that's been sitting there for 8 years, you know, with graffiti on it, is somehow somebody's going to come along and put a new retail facility in there, when it just, in today's world, especially post-COVID, it's just incredibly unlikely to happen. So I can tell you now from firsthand experience, Mike, over the last 3 years doing this, the number of deals that we've seen and underwritten and brought in that actually get through the council and the public hearings and the steps you need to take to get them converted is incredibly low. So, and you know, our business development head, Kellen Stevens, that you know, has scoured the country. Literally, we've talked to just about every conceivable self-storage operator we can find, and very, very few of them are engaged or involved in conversions, precisely because it's so much work and it's so difficult to go through that process. So all of that helps me get comfortable with, you know, the supply issue on these conversions. And I like it because the basis we can get in by buying a distressed retail property, you know, and then converting it to storage is actually quite good. the real challenge, Mike, has been what I just mentioned, getting it through the city. And the second one is that the deal sizes are just so small that it's really difficult to aggregate enough product, you know, to make it, you know, worth all the time and the effort and the energy that goes into doing all that. So love the margins, love the numbers, but it's a tough business model to execute.
Yeah, great commentary, Matt. Thank you for correcting me. I meant to say cheaper, generally, not easier. If you get at the right cost basis, the conversion should.
That's right. And that's the advantage. You know, you buy a vacant building that's been sitting there for a long time. Oftentimes you can pick it up for close to land value. And since the shell is already there, if it's in good condition, your cost of build out is much less than building it from the ground up. So, you know, that's the thesis is you get in at 60-70% of what you can get in from the ground up, and you end up with a Class A facility on a major arterial, right, with a lot of traffic count in an infill location with limited supply. And we've been able to find them, but I mean, Mike, you got to go through it's a bit of a needle in the haystack to find the right one that has those combination of factors where it meets both the metric, the supply metrics, the other metrics, and you can get it through the municipality to get it approved.
Yeah, that's the value you bring, because you're right. It's very hard to find these projects, and when you find them, they are kind of a gem. Let's switch for just the last few minutes. Talk a little bit about Verivest, and we use Verivest. I just wanted to kind of cover. It's a great fund administration platform. You have a phenomenal team. I know you're launching a tax practice too, but just wanted to chat a little bit about Verivest listing. One of the things that Verivest does is it vets sponsors. It does background check. It does due diligence. So on top of the administration, it becomes a good platform for investors to take a look at who are the Verivest verified sponsors. Could you talk a little bit about this platform?
Yeah, I mean, the platform started as a fund administration business to provide the ongoing accounting and investor waterfall calculations on behalf of people who came through our advisory practice to set up their own fund. And over time, it has morphed, Mike, into it still does that. And ultimately, it's expanding those services to include all the way through the preparation of the taxes for the syndication and fund entities that we serve. But what we're really looking forward to these days is, I think for investors, one of the biggest challenges when picking a manager or a deal is especially for high net worth investors who might be investing $50,000 or $100,000 or a couple $100,000, you know, any one individual really doesn't have the ability to do the level of due diligence and homework on those deals and those managers that they probably should be doing and that they would like to do. And it's not necessarily that the manager doesn't want them to do it, but it's impractical for the manager to do that for every $50,000 check. I mean, if they have to fund a $3 or $4 million deal and the average check size $100,000, that's 30 or 40 investors. I mean, it's a lot of work for that sponsor. So the whole concept behind what Verivest is doing is to allow sponsors to aggregate that information, provide Verivest can do upfront background work on that sponsor in terms of verifying background checks, employment, securities counsel, monitoring, verification that the representations the manager's making about their prior track record have been verified and are in fact accurate. So an investor, it's really a directory listing where sponsors can come on, get themselves out there into the world in a way that the investor knows that a third party has verified information on that sponsor to help corroborate that those people are, you know, legitimate operators who can pass that background check and who have done what they say they've done. And it's still a work in progress, Mike, but we've got, I think, 9 or 10 on there now. We've got 37 and climbing people who are in the process of going through those background checks and so forth. And ultimately, we expect it to be a portal that investors can go to have far more confidence in the managers they're investing with.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I absolutely love it. There's so many deals circulating out there. It's almost funny how I got emails from many people. Look at this deal. Look at that deal. The first thing I ask is, how do you know the sponsor? Oh, I got an email from them. Are you kidding me? You don't know who the person is and you want me to look at their deal? If they're not a verified sponsor, if it's not an existing relationship, if it's not a strong referral, why in the world do they even want to waste time looking at those? Because there's a lot of comedians, great marketers with extremely crappy deals and no ability to run. And the value...
Sorry to interrupt you, Mike, but here's the best analogy I can give you. It's a bit like Carfax for investors in the real estate industry, right? If you're buying a used car, you know, it might look beautiful on the outside, but how do you know that it wasn't totaled and it wasn't rebuilt, or that it wasn't, you know, the title wasn't, it wasn't stolen, right? That's what Carfax does for, you know, people who want to buy a used car. Is they verify that what they're getting is what they think they're getting. You know, it's very similar for an investor. They don't really have the ability to know that information. And by having an independent, you know, third party that they can trust, it provides meaningful, valuable information to help them make a better decision on the front end.
Yeah, I think it's a great service. It's a great analogy. I appreciate that. It's so good. I've talked to Lance a couple of times. We have a couple of potential projects we're looking at, some really good sponsors, but I want them to go to Verivest Verified. I've talked to sponsors and said, listen, guys, I'd like you to get your background done and check on your track record by Verivest, because it's a lot of hard work and it's systematic work and it needs a well-developed process. So I appreciate it very much, and we're thinking to recommend a few folks before we can do any business with them, but they got to get themselves checked through the Verivest platform. So
yeah, and the last comment I'd make there, Mike, and the value prop to the sponsors is that, you know, if you are a good operator, this gives you a way to systematically enable yourself to be more attractive to capital. I mean, it increases your institutional readiness. And once you start going through the process of verifying and monitoring your ongoing performance, you know, it makes it that much easier for you to gain credibility with your investors on the front end. And it's super inexpensive and affordable to be able to do. It's amazing to me how few people will take the time to do that. So we think it's going to be a really good service for both the sponsors and the investors. And we're very excited about it.
Yeah, I agree. And the reason there are very few people, because there are very few very good people. A lot of comedians out there with they can't pass the mustard, and so they won't subject themselves to bad review. So the good guys that wind up actually going through the process, there are only a few of them. Anyway, thank you for your wisdom. Thank you for your time. How would listeners reach out to you if they were interested to learn more about Fairway Self-Storage Fund or your Fairway Equity offering, which we haven't talked about, but you have a great offering there, and then your Fund 7 and so on? What's the best way to, where should they go?
Yeah, you can reach out to me directly at my email address, which is matt.burk@fairwayamerica.com. And depending on, you know, whether it's a sponsor or investor, I'd be more than happy to direct people to the right resource. And so, yeah, reach out directly, matt.burk@fairwayamerica.com.
Thank you kindly. And it's just a general website, fairwayamerica.com or verivest.com, just like it sounds. Once again, Matt, thank you for coming on the podcast. I'm honored and humbled. And as always, you provide great, great thoughts and commentary and a lot of wisdom. So thank you so much.
Mike, thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure working with you and chatting with you. So thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Big Mike Fund Podcast. To receive your copy of Mike's How to Choose a Smart Real Estate Fund book, head to BigMikeFund.com or visit Amazon and type Mike Zlotnick. Keep listening and keep investing Big Mike style. See you on the next episode.